Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, January 16, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Well, I want to welcome people who have dialed in or people who may download this later as a podcast. I'm Jeremy Rapkin from the George Mason School of Law in Arlington, Virginia. I'm just acting as the host here. We're having a discussion now about the new Department of Defense Law of War Manual, which just came out a few months ago. And it's a discussion between two of the most qualified people outside the Pentagon at this point to discuss this. And they are first General Charles Dunlap, who served for 34 years in the United States Air Force as a judge advocate general. He retired in 2010 as a major general, and he was then deputy judge advocate general of the United States Air Force. Since then, he's been a professor at Duke University and at the law school and director of their Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security. He writes many different topics related to the military justice system and the law of armed conflict, and is somebody who has taught this and practiced it, that is the law of armed conflict and military justice. So he's a terrific person to have. Also, we have Michael Newton, whose career was in the Army. He is actually a graduate of West Point and got his law degree at the University of Virginia. He was active in a variety of roles in as an Army lawyer, including advising on the elements of crimes for the International Criminal Court and the trial of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. He has been since 2005 in civilian life, professor of the practice of law at Vanderbilt School of Law. I should mention one other thing about these gentlemen. About 10 years ago, I published an article, just an op-ed piece, and I mentioned at the beginning this new term, lawfare, which I attributed to Mike Newton because I'd heard him talk about it. And I got a very nice email from General Dunlap saying it was a nice article, but I'm really the person who coined that term. And I have since gone on the internet and looked. I think most people are crediting General Dunlap with coining that phrase, but certainly both of these guys were very alert to the challenge of people manipulating and abusing the rules of war for political advantage. I wanted to say a word before we start this discussion about Michael Lewis, because we're having this discussion in honor of Michael Lewis, who was a longtime active member of the Federalist Society. We hope to do a Michael Lewis podcast every year on some topic related to the law of armed conflict. He was a Navy pilot. He flew F-14s in the Gulf War in 1991 and in operations after that to protect the Kurds. Then he went to the Harvard Law School. He was in private practice. Then he was teaching for almost a decade at Ohio Northern University. He was very active in debates about national security law. One of my colleagues at the Federalist Society described him as fearless, and he meant that not about being a Navy pilot, which, you know, you have to be very brave for that, but my colleague meant this as a reference to his engagement in public debates about national security. A lot of people who were on the other side in those debates praised him as somebody who was thoughtful and fair-minded, even though they didn't agree with him. He was a true gentleman. It was a real loss, not only to the Federalist Society and his friends, but I think to national security debate in America. He died very prematurely earlier, I was going to say earlier this year, last year in 2015. And he very much deserves to have his name perpetuated in debates about national security law. Maybe my partners here want to say a word about him because you both knew him.
Well, yeah, I would, Jeremy. Mike undoubtedly was one of the foremost authorities in the law of war. And he did something that, you know, all of us aspire to. He was so familiar with the business of war, meaning he knew the weapons, he knew the strategies, he knew the thinking of people in the military. And he brought that to bear in his analysis of the legal issues that would arise. And I think Mike had a very keen understanding that in this area of the law, the, you know, the client, so to speak, knowing the client's business is absolutely critically important. There are lots of people out there in academia and elsewhere who are, quite honestly, very erudite in the law, but they continue to misunderstand things because they don't understand the client's business, so to speak. They don't understand how the weapons work. They don't understand the strategies, and they don't understand the mindset. It is just a huge loss that, you know, with the premature passing of Mike Lewis. But I would echo what your colleague had said. He really was fearless. He would often be the one person with a different point of view in a whole cacophony of voices and other panelists and so forth in different venues. And I think he brought a much-needed balance to the national security debate, and we really do mourn his loss. He left us much too soon.
Yeah, and this is of course, Mike Newton, and I don't want to pile on. I agree with everything that's been said. I just want to add a couple of small points. One, it's a great honor to participate in this precisely because both Charlie and I knew Mike and valued him and valued his contributions. I have to say, combined with all of the expertise and all of the commitment to engage and to try to educate and to try to be a voice of reason in these very complex debates, you know, Mike had a heart of service too, and he was never afraid. Part of the fearless part is he's never afraid to go out and be on the front end of that spear to engage in those debates. And you know, this is the kind of thing where if a net call went out and said, hey, we need to have a good, thoughtful conversation on this issue, there's not much doubt that he would have been one of the first ones to pick up the phone or the email and say, I would like to help. How can I help? And so in initiating this podcast series in his honor, I think that's one of the important voids that the Federalist Society is trying to fill, which is to engage on core issues where expert perspectives are needed. And that's very much in the spirit that Mike would have brought to these kinds of conversations. And the second observation, which is just from knowing him, it's oftentimes not just the act of engaging, it's the spirit of the engagement, the way we engage, the comradeship, the smile, the great expertise without just rubbing people's faces at it. And you know, as we begin to think about the law of armed conflict and the law of war over the next decade or so, representing U.S. positions where we disagree with friends or allies or they have different legal obligations than we do or they see the law differently than we do, certainly that's true with the ICRC. It's certainly true within NATO. You know, it's really important for us to engage, but also to engage in the right way, to try to be productive, to try to work towards. Otherwise, you know, we're sort of frozen, and we all agree to disagree. And I think Mike would agree with this statement I'm about to make. The law here is too important for us to just throw up our hands and say, well, it's hard, and nobody's really quite sure how it works, so let's just all do our own thing. I don't think that's the appropriate position, and I don't think Mike would be settled for that.
Yes. I could not agree more. That brilliantly stated, Mike.
I just want to add one word, which is from everything that's been said, which it certainly resonates with me. I saw him speak a number of times. I was at a number of conferences with him. It should also be mentioned, you're making him sound very, very serious, which he was that, but he was also fun. He was a good guy to go out drinking with afterwards.
And one last footnote about Mike. I did have the privilege of going out to Ohio Northern. And apart from his academic life and his public life, he was extremely committed to students and student development. You know, he really built from you know, the ground up, in essence, a national security law of armed conflict program out there. And I think he you know, inspired a whole generation of young people in this area of the law, and he did it in the right way. And he really, really will be missed in the community.
So before we start, Charlie Dunlap, you are having a conference at Duke at the end.
Jeremy, and we each year the Center on Law Ethics and National Security here at Duke Law School has a conference, and this year the conference is Friday, February 26th, and Saturday, February 27th. And the theme of the conference is sort of a hot issue. It, and I'll try to verbalize it for you. It's hybrid war equals hybrid law, question mark, because I'm not so sure it does. And I think we want to have a conversation about that. But we're going to be talking about how the concept of hybrid war or gray war, which the operators are talking about quite a bit. And it's, to oversimplify it, it would be the use of various, you know, conventional forces, but also unconventional forces, cyber, propaganda, spying, covert operations, sort of what the Russians did in Crimea is what a lot of people are, how they might characterize it. But anyway, it does seem like it's the future of war, and we're going to have a number of panels that are going to address different aspects of it, how it impacts the law of armed conflict. Mike's going to come out and be on a panel with us on autonomous weapons and the implications of that. Vice Admiral Jim Crawford is going to be our dinner speaker. He's the Judge Advocate General of the Navy. And one of the don't miss presentations is going to be by Professor Nita Farahani. Professor Farahani also holds a chair not only at the law school, but she is also a bioethicist. And she's going to be teaching about or speaking about what neuroscience will bring to future war in terms of enhancing human beings and soldiers. The we're on the verge of the soup being able to develop the super soldier, but also other things, how interrogations in the future may be changed because you can get answers without the person speaking, and of course without the use of coercion or torture or anything like that. Very interesting work she's doing. But in any event, those who might be interested can now go to the center's website. That's the Center on Law, Ethics, and National Security on the Duke Law School website and register. And I would urge people to do it early because it does book up rather quickly, and it will be open to the public beginning on Tuesday, but it, actually, if you go to the website now, you can sign up.
Good. Thank you. So let's talk about this manual. Let me just, for listeners who aren't really familiar with this, let me just mention a few background facts, and then we can start the discussion. This thing is like a phone book. 1,200 pages, and it's the first manual of its kind that applies to all of the services. There used to be separate manuals for the Army, for the Air Force, for the Navy, and they were manuals. They were 100 pages or so. I guess the Navy one was a bit longer, but they were small things. And this is a huge thing. This is, people have described it as a treatise. It's been at least 10 years in the making. Was this a good idea? Why did we need this? Are we going to be glad that we have all of this put together in one massive volume? Let's just get initial thoughts about the project.
Well, to paraphrase the famous line of the famous book, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. You know, in one sense, the new manual serves as almost an exhaustive compilation of issues, so it pulls together issues, and now the services are having to struggle. It was a more than a two-decade process, actually.
Yeah.
began early in the 80s. And, you know, and you think, well, how could that possibly be? It began with the DoD Law War Working Group, real experts from within the departments, but collected from the services. This was not a, the DoD Law War Working Group really originated and was grounded in the services, which is important. It was through two-thirds of its life in this particular project, grounded in the real core expertise drawn from the various services. Everybody knew that the respective service manuals, in some cases, had been overcome by events. In some cases, the law had changed. In some cases, U.S. policy positions with respect to the law had generated enormous debates overseas. And, of course, in the 80s and 90s, we saw an explosion of military operations that raised just a host. And General Dunlap and I can sort of give bunches and bunches of examples here of areas where the law itself, the rule is clear, but the application of the rule far from clear, engendering much debate, sometimes impeding coalition operations and multinational operations. So there was a need. The challenge was to try to do something that helped people and added to the debate. And places where we've done that, and there's places where we haven't.
I first just want you guys to focus on just some basic questions about the format of this. I think the last Air Force manual was done in the mid-1970s, so you could certainly understand why people would think, that needs to be updated. Was it a good idea to have all the different services in one huge volume?
I personally think so. You know, when you're on an operation, I think Mike knows this well, it doesn't work if coalition partners think that, well, if you talk to a U.S. Air Force person, you'll get one answer on the law, and U.S. Army person or U.S. Navy. You really can't do business in the 21st century that way. I also thought it was extremely necessary for the simple fact you should not have troops in the field trying to execute operations when you can't tell them definitively how the U.S. interprets the law, or at least how the Department of Defense interprets the law as to what standards they're going to be held to. So I think it was very necessary. Some people have complained about the size. I don't think that's a big issue in that, you know, with various electronic devices, you can put 1,000 pages on a cell phone. So it's the size itself is not, to me anyway, a problem. How accessible it is for non-experts, I think that you do need to know something about the law to use this treatise.
Let me pose a question to you. I think anybody who looked at the previous manuals would understand that you're just getting a broad brushstroke sketch, and it obviously requires a lot of interpretation. When you got 1,000 pages, it looks like this is it. This is the definitive treatment of all these issues. Maybe there's something about it that's overambitious or misleading, and that it suggests that there can be more precision in applying the law or determining the law than is really feasible in real life?
Well, I'll let Mike, I'm very anxious to hear what Mike has to say about this, but when you actually look at the manual, there's still the whole issue of applying the facts to what the manual has to say, not to mention interpreting what the manual has to say. And while I do think that they did a pretty good job in most areas, there's a couple of areas that are you have to really sort of know what you're doing, or at least be prepared to think through very carefully what the words say and to try to figure them out. It was an enormous undertaking, and it covers a lot of areas. So I personally don't think that, a shorter volume, a less involved volume would really work in the 21st century. I do think that it's intended to be a living document. Rather unusually, they invite comments. There's going to be iterations of it. You know, maybe even this year we could see some revisions. So revisions in the sense of more of clarifications, I think, than maybe fundamental policy shifts. I think the policies are pretty well laid out there, but in terms of facilitating the interpretation, I think we could see some tweaks sooner
rather
than later.
Any thoughts on why it took so long? I remember a couple of years ago, Hayes Parks published an article saying, we had this finished at the end of the Bush administration, and why has it been delayed for
years? Well, I'm 100% sure that the delay had everything to do with the interagency coordination process. And in fact, one of the critiques of the manual is that it explicitly states that it doesn't necessarily reflect anything more than the opinion of the Department of Defense. In other words, it doesn't necessarily reflect the opinion of other agencies of government. I think that in the real world, and again, I want to hear what Mike has to say, I think that the world will consider it the statement of the U.S.'s view of the law of war, notwithstanding the disclaimers that are embedded in it.
Well, I think that's right. Although one of the critiques that is beginning to surface, and I've got some positive observations, this would be one of my critiques, is where we've just stated a flat U.S. position, there's really not, for those who are experts in this field who are really been watching this over the last two decades, there's not that much new in the manual in terms of restating positions. I do think people will look at this as the opportunity to both defend those positions, to amplify those positions, to fill gaps. And there are places where we don't necessarily do that. We just say, this is our position. And we drop a footnote to a speech. You know, one of the things that intimidates people is the number of footnotes and the complexity of the document. A very high percentage of the footnotes are simply directions within the document itself. You know, so on this issue, see this paragraph. So it's cross-referencing the footnotes. And so, you know, some people will see that as a good thing because it's helping you give this roadmap through this huge document. There are big chunks of the text where I know there are better arguments to be made than what we're making, or I see missed opportunities or missed citations. So I do think it's important that you know, people come in with comments, and we focus on where positions need to be strengthened, because NGOs and other countries will look to this as a primary source, and if we don't do a better job of supporting some of the positions, then we're on the risk of having the ground shift under our feet.
And just to be clear, none of this is binding on the next administration, right? Donald Trump, if he wants to, can just toss this out and say it was done by stupid people, as he likes to say, or Bernie Sanders, or whoever the next president is, right?
I think Mike made an important point, which I think is lost on some people. There isn't that much new in the manual. It's mainly bringing together a disparate number of things into collecting them into one document. So, you know, in the sense of another administration coming in and throwing the whole thing out, of course they could do that because it's an administrative document. But in terms of what the law is and what the U.S. position has been, that would not be that easy to do. And, you know, obviously you can't change the Geneva Conventions short of withdrawing from them. But I do think that this will – and I don't think a new administration would come in and toss the whole thing out, for lots of reasons, even though it obviously did not get interagency approval. That, I think, was the original thought. I think what, reading between the lines, and I don't particularly have inside knowledge, is that while the interagency did not want to agree, it at least got to the point where it was not opposing. And I think that is the reason, as Mike says, there isn't a lot new in the manual. It's but it does collect in one place a lot of those views. And I also agree with Mike that there are things in there that need to be better defended and better explained. And there are some, I won't say outright inconsistencies, but if you look hard at it, you'll see some what people could understandably say are inconsistencies. And I'm thinking when we have a chance to talk about the cyber operations chapter and the interpretation of force and armed force and the U.S. position on that, that's not fully clarified as to the rationale for that, and I think it needs to be.
Okay, I thought, but just one more thing, just in general, so my understanding is this is something that's available online. The printed version is not even distributed by the government, and so the government can, whenever it wants to, just say, for example, Chapter 16 on cyber operations, that's withdrawn and replaced by a new and improved version, and they can do that from one day to the next, right? There's no...
Oh, yeah, they can, and there's lots of... In fact, most regulations are like that. You know, the Air Force doctrine, for example, you know, not the legal doctrine, but there is now wholly exist online, and they... for that purpose, so they can go in and update it in real time as opposed to waiting for a publication cycle.
There's no formal procedure. I mean, people would be upset if they did this impulsively, right? But
although I have to say, you know, it strikes me, I smile when I hear the phrase, the bureaucracy will change this from one day to the next. You know, this thing moved at a glacial pace.
Yes.
In part because, you know, even where there was not much shifting on the underlying policy node, you know, the examples and the problems that surface, and I do commend them for, in some places, a notable effort to try to grapple with some of the applications issues that arose, you know, in the Army sense from the 1956 Law War Manual. That's a tremendously important thing. Nothing will happen slowly with respect to additions or changes.
Nothing will happen speedily.
I'm sorry, speedily. I do think it would be great if we had, in this electronic age, a really available platform to make changes. You know, you see that with the joint manuals, where you can go online and it'll say, here's the latest update as of this date. And that, I think, would be very important, particularly in places. I mean, let's be clear for people who aren't really grounded and haven't taken the time to go through all these footnotes and all this stuff, and I confess, I didn't read every single footnote. There's a lot of places where we give examples of state practice. And yet, I'm reading it thinking, oh, here's a better example. Here's a counterexample. There's a lot more meat that can be done to support, and I think, if you think of crowdsourcing, that's where the strength of this thing is going to come from, is where people really chime in and say, oh, but this could be much, much stronger. It's much more persuasive on this line. And I just hope that the bureaucracy is flexible enough to take that kind of input, to incorporate it, to adjust it, and then, I don't know, reissue, re-clarify, add, you know, as shocking as it says to add footnotes, but that's really, in my view, part of what's needed going forward.
I'm with Mike on that, and there's a tremendous opportunity to do that, and we see that in other areas. There are textbooks now that really are living documents that, you know, evolve as needs evolve. And I also think that I am not concerned, personally, if it grows to 2,000 pages, because if you have the right search capability and you have it on a handheld platform, you can get some, no matter where you are, you'd be able to have access to some fairly sophisticated legal analysis, which in my mind is a good thing. So, and we're seeing things evolve before our eyes, you know. Mike, I don't know how much you've thought about this, but this whole idea of attacking oil tankers yesterday, or in the past few days, they bombed a bank literally to destroy the money that was being used to fund ISIS. these are targeting issues that are incorporating themselves into state practice almost without discussion, even though I would suggest that at least in academic circles not too long ago, there'd be much more of a discussion about striking war-supporting facilities and so forth as opposed to things more directly linked to actual combat activities.
But, well, this would be, I think, a good bridge to the first substantive element of the manual that I thought we could talk about, which is the treatment of proportionality. And I just want to mention that Michael Newton has published a book with Oxford University Press, Proportionality in International Law. This came out last year, I guess 2014. It's mostly about the law of armed conflict, although it has some interesting comparisons with trade law and other areas of international law. So you're on top of this. You're one of the great experts on this, Mike Newton. Did they do a good job in the discussion of proportionality in the new manual?
Well, sort of. All the key pieces are there. What's missing, a couple of things. One is the context. I think the context isn't as good. It's a very narrow lens that they look through the law of proportionality. And one of the reasons we did the book and one of the mistakes in the manual is the same word is used, and this gets back to something that General Dunlap said just a few minutes ago, the same word, the same concept is used in different ways in different places. And that was the genesis of the proportionality book, was to say, is that necessary? There's a push for homogeneity. I think on the substance, the manual is exactly right, because it's very clear, different applications, different meaning in different areas of the law. When I say it's missing a bit of context, there's the simple assertion of these things as U.S. policy. Even where I think we're right, we need to understand that there are other people out there who feel differently and other states who feel differently and want to push for homogeneity. And so we're not as alert as we need to be to areas where we can make our arguments much, much, much stronger. And in the proportionality context, I could give you some examples. There's another interesting thing about proportionality, though, that I think they got exactly right. And it was a subject of, by some other sources, a subject of much debate. In the many, many hands that this passed through and the many political officials and the many meetings, at one point there was an effort to try to elevate proportionality as being the most important, the pinnacle, the one dominant factor. And that had not been contained in earlier drafts. It was not in the earlier Hayes drafts, which make proportionality
And it sure is not in earlier manuals.
Exactly. Right. And so the point is that proportionality, we can focus on it, but if you do proportionality, you got to get distinction right before you ever get to proportionality. You got to have military necessity right, all the other principles. And then proportionality is the one that tends to get the public debate. And I think they got that exactly right. I do think there are parts of the way they talk about proportionality where we missed opportunities. That's kind of my theme. We missed some opportunities to buttress the strength of our arguments, notwithstanding footnotes that are dropped. I look at a lot of the footnotes and I say, well, there's better case law. There's better examples of state practice that we missed.
It seemed to me, just in browsing through the manual, that footnotes were almost entirely, this is what we have said, or this is in a treaty, not a lot of references to what other states have claimed as, or even what other states have done in state practice. Was that deliberate? And does it make a big difference in an area like this and thinking about how we should understand proportionality? Maybe they should have said, European commentators have said this, but we reject that.
Oh, I would absolutely be in that camp. I mean, I just did a whole book essentially saying that.
Yes.
Let me give you one example. I could give you a proportionality example if you want, or one from
Give us a proportionality example.
So the proportionality example, the question is, for those who don't know the law here or haven't really thought about this lately, and we state the law correctly from Protocol 1, that you know, strikes are forbidden and that are launched in the knowledge that the strike will cause damage that is excessive in relation to the concrete and direct overall military advantage anticipated. Now, I use the word overall. The law is extremely clear, and the U.S. position is extremely clear, that we're allowed to consider a far broader context than the narrow tactical setting. I mean, the classic example is, can you bomb the bridge in Kosovo when there's no enemy tanks on the bridge? Absolutely you can. And that same question, where the overall military advantage is a perfectly permissible component of a proportionality circumstance, we missed a huge opportunity. Now, that language shows up in Article 8 of the Rome Statute. I think I read between the lines. I think people must have had a political reason not to want to use the current correct articulation. But the fact is that limits unnecessarily American commanders trying to apply that principle down the line. And to that extent, even though we're right on the law, we don't support it as well as we could. And the same thing for the test itself. It's got to be clearly excessive. It's not where we have mathematicians and algebraic analysis of proportionality. That's not what the principle's about. It's about the abusive process.
Just to footnote Mike, number one, for the listeners, Mike's book on proportionality is the treatise on it. It's extraordinarily rich. He looks at proportionality very, very broadly, and then he brings it down and has lots of examples and so forth, and I highly recommend it. And this discussion of proportionality is extremely important because in the popular press and elsewhere, you know, there are advocates who will not even relate the law correctly. They don't. They want to go with some sort of mathematical analysis. They completely misinterpret it. You never hear the words excessive in relation. So this is not an insignificant thing. But I also think Mike has made an important point, and I do think the manual does a reasonable job with this, is that, you know, you don't get to proportionality until you've worked your way through military necessity and military objective and so forth. And people don't want to have to think through those things, even though there's, you know, that's the way you really have to practice in this area of the law, because you can get to the wrong place if you try to shortcut it. And
do you both agree? You gave this example a few minutes ago, bombing a bank to destroy ISIS currency. Do you both agree? Yes, that's okay. And if people got killed, that's still okay?
I would have to know some more facts about it.
That's fair.
You know, if it's the payroll for ISIS fighters, in the sense it's the military payroll, I can work my way through that. If it's the money that ISIS is using to support its quote unquote government, so to speak, and the provision of services, you know, if it's the money used to pay the guy who runs the you know, the electrical plant or the water distillation plant or whatever they have, I would have to know more facts about it. I am actually rather comfortable with bombing the oil tankers. So
because,
you know,
it's their revenue.
It's revenue, and that actual revenue stream seems to be more directly related to fighters. I don't know what I don't know, obviously, but I'd be interested to hear Mike's view on that.
Well, one of the you know, the manuals are very interesting when you look at it with really informed eyes, having watched this debate for a long time. It's this really interesting mosaic of language pulled out. You know, some cases there's language from the 1899 Hague regulations, and in the next paragraph an example from Afghanistan with a footnote from Afghanistan. So it's this very interesting compilation. I think the manual does a really nice job of laying out for somebody who has the time and the patience to go through it all of the considerations. And, you know, there's one specific place where it says, don't ever forget, even when you meet proportionality, you still have the duty to take all feasible measures to minimize or to eliminate. And that's actually an important contribution because, you know, the United States will have different policy prerogatives and different national positions. We do have one position on proportionality and a separate position on the scope of the duty, the scope of what's feasible. Feasible does not mean everything imaginable. It means what's feasible, what's practical. We've said that in our treaty reservations. Our NATO allies have said that in their treaty reservations. And the manual does a really nice job of laying out not just a macro policy, but many of the sort of the wrinkles that are necessary within that policy. Now, to be clear, I think sometimes it does it in a bit of an awkward way. It'll say, oh, by the way, footnote, go to this other paragraph some 400 pages later, and you got to think about these two things together. So the manual is not for the faint of heart, I will say that.
Yes, that's for sure.
I agree with that. And that's been one of the critiques of it, is that, well, you know, this is not something a commander can pick up and use. That might be true, but the fact of the matter is that the law is complex. You know, the commander doesn't pick up the tax code. And in fact, commanders don't pick up the operating manual for an M1A1. You know, so you know, we live in an era of complexity, and the law can be complex. But I think the challenge here is that we have to be growing a cadre of military lawyers and civilian analogs who not only understand this, extensive, body of law as reflected in the manual and other treatises, but also the complexity of modern military weapons and methodologies. And I do worry about growing that kind of expertise, because it is a process that requires a lot of investment. We're not seeing that much on the academic side. I think that there are lots of academics who are, as I say, very erudite in the law, but they are, I still go to conferences where people talk about, you know, the U.S. carpet bombing this or that, and not really understanding, you know, that's not the way things are done and so forth.
So I want to move on to another topic, but maybe I can just set this up by picking up something that you just said about our needing people who have close-in expertise or experience with military operations. I thought we could talk for a little about the chapter in this manual on cyber operations. And one of the reasons that seems to me a big challenge is nobody has a lot of experience with that. It's all kind of future-oriented. And there's the additional problem, particularly there, that there's a lot of other countries that have the potential to engage in this or may be affected by what we do in this area. And so you might wonder whether it is enough to have American military lawyers working for the government saying, well, we're satisfied, and go home. I mean, maybe cyber is a good example of something where we need to have a larger international discussion. Or am I wrong about that? Did the chapter satisfy you as that's good enough?
Well, I think the chapter was groundbreaking in that there was a chapter.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't that long ago that even any suggestion of anything that even vaguely related to offensive cyber operations was highly classified. Even the doctrine was only declassified, I think, in 2014. So I think it's a huge step forward that they had anything. And so now, having said that, I do think that in this area, the bigger tent is a positive. And with respect, by the way, just as a comment, to other areas.
And
I think academic.
Do you regard this as a big tent statement?
I think that they lay out the U.S. position. And what's interesting, I think, about the chapter is that it doesn't, I don't believe it cites the Tallinn Manual at all. And for those listeners who are perhaps are not familiar with it, the Tallinn Manual was a effort sponsored by NATO. It's not officially a NATO document. It hasn't been formally adopted by any countries, but it's a rather extensive statement by a collection of experts under the editorship of Professor Mike Schmidt up at the U.S. Naval War College that brought together these experts for the purpose of stating the law as it is today as it relates to cyber. And I think that they did a pretty good job. That said, one of the, I think, controversial things that's in the manual is the restatement of the U.S. position as it relates to force. And in the U.N. Charter in paragraph 2, sub 4, is the basic, basic proposition that the use or threat of force is, unlawful in the modern era for everybody who's a member of the U.N. But in Article 51 of the U.N. Charter, which is self-defense, it talks about the authority to use self-defense under circumstances where an armed attack had taken place. And I think many international lawyers, in fact, the majority of international lawyers, found that the way force is used in Article 2 is different from armed force as used in Article 51, and that's what the Tallinn Manual reflects. And so there's some analysis as what it takes to be armed force. But in the chapter in the DoD manual on cyber, they reflect the Harold Coe position. When Harold Coe was the legal advisor to the State Department, he gave a speech that the U.S. doesn't draw any distinction between force as used in Article 2 and armed force as used in Article 51, which is a pretty significant statement, so that the U.S. position is that any measure of unlawful force triggers a right to self-defense. I think what we'll have to see in the future is exactly what that means. Does that mean a use of force that would most scholars would think is below the threshold of armed force would nevertheless authorize a kinetic response? Or is he really talking about countermeasures and retorsion and things like that? I'm not so sure.
Just to make this concrete, those NATO advisors were meeting in Tallinn, as I understand it, because Estonia had been the victim of a cyber attack, some of the elements of which seemed to use Cyrillic letters, so it seemed to be coming from Russia. But it didn't turn off the water supply. It didn't turn off the lights. It just turned off, government websites.
It was a kind of
act of vandalism, right? And so there's a dispute about, well, this was some kind of attack. I mean, it was a cyber attack, you could say, but it wasn't the same. I mean, it didn't break any windows, let alone kill anyone. So could you trigger the NATO treaty? And if not the NATO treaty, what exactly, right? That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, those are the kinds of issues. In fact, some people would say that what Estonia underwent was not an attack at all within the meaning of international law. And that's the debate that's ongoing. But I do think that it was wise to have at least a chapter. It's a relatively short chapter in the manual. But at least it does lay out some basics, and it puts the U.S. position out there.
Well, let me add to that. It's my favorite chapter because it's the shortest. but I do think it's important to state it. But this chapter, for somebody out there who doesn't want to plow through the whole manual, this is a good sort of a dip your toe in the water, and it's a nice illustration of the kinds of things we're talking about. On the positive side, there's clear statements of U.S. policy and of U.S. legal positions that the law of war, there's some people who say, cyber is a new domain of warfare, so we need a whole new set of legal regime. The U.S. position has been and consistent with other areas of the law, where the law is vibrant. It's intended to grow. It's the big principles. Now what we're talking about is a new application of those principles, and let's figure out what that actually means. At the same time, there's a lot of places in the manual where we say the absolutely correct thing, but we stop short of really fully explaining or developing. I'll give you an example. Paragraph 16.3.3.2, and this one just stuck out to me. In the discussions when Sony was under attack from, allegedly in the public reports, North Korea, the White House press spokesman stood up and he said, you know, make no mistake, we will respond to this, and we will respond in a proportionate way. And I kept waiting for him to say, you know, as described in Chapter 11 of Professor Newton's proportionality book. Well, here's an example. Because in the paragraph, we simply say, in the cyber context, we will respond in accordance, or as dictated by, the principles of necessity and proportionality. Totally correct statement of the law. What's missing, though, is which version of proportionality. Are we talking about, you know, retortion, a countermeasure, one set of legal principles? If we're going to talk about it that way, we've got to make these factual legal findings. If we're going to talk about it as an act of self-defense, you know, it's got to meet these legal thresholds, and we've got to know what our military objective is, which means we've got to clearly know the scope of the damage. Well, in many cyber attacks, that's impossible as an a priori matter. It's only in hindsight that we fully understand. I mean, if you've been following the papers about the data breaches in the Pentagon, they still don't know the breadth of the damage precisely. So to impose a legal standard, I think in the next iteration of the manual, I want to have a red team, and this is my humble suggestion to DOD. Have a red team. Have Charlie Daniels and Charlie Dunlap and Charlie Daniels, the country singer, and Mike Newton, and all these people come in and read this stuff and say, you know, even where we think you're right, this is misleading, and allows other people to frame these arguments in ways that actually undercut U.S. interests. That's the danger here, because I think, you know, in so many pages, you know, General Dunlap used the phrase inconsistencies. There's some apparent inconsistencies here that I don't think are intended to be inconsistencies. And we've got to help try to fill some of those gaps as we evolve this thing.
Well, let's take up a different topic, which is, I think, something is not about anything new. It's just something that people are more upset about, and that is there's a little bit of discussion about the protections of non-belligerence, and in the midst of that discussion about journalists, and quite a few people who are journalists raised a fuss about this and said this was changing what they thought the law had been. This was requiring them to be registered. This was requiring them to be under military control. Did you think there was actually a change in the treatment of journalists in this manual?
I don't think that there is a change. I think that it was awkwardly presented. And I think people were reacting to the Massoud case. For those listeners who don't know, I think it's actually the day before September 11th. It was like September 10th. Massoud, who was a leader in the Northern Alliance, kind of a good guy, was interviewed by people purporting to be journalists and ended up blowing up and killing them. And so I think that and I'm guessing on this, that the manual wanted to alert people that, you know, there is that kind of threat these days. And then I think also one of the modern issues is that everybody's a journalist these days. You know, if you have a blog, are you a, quote, citizen journalist, which is one of the terms you'll see. And so there, and the growth of embedded journalists and all kinds of people roaming around the battlefield calling themselves journalists, I think that they were trying to a little bit get a handle on that. But it had a reaction. The New York Times had a big op-ed about it where they got the law almost completely wrong. But they had an emotional reaction to it because, I think the Washington Post has a journalist who's in Iran who's been convicted of espionage and so forth. So they're very sensitive to it. But the idea that, you know, journalist or any profession could, any seeming civilian profession could not be used as a cover for, you know, covert activities by adversaries is ridiculous. So,
Isn't it true, though, that none of the earlier manuals had any discussion of journalists?
I think that there's a difference between journalists and war correspondents. You know, war correspondents, I think, are more closer to embeds, and they have there's a little bit of a distinction, and Mike helped me on this, in the law of war between the two. But I think that there had always been some discussion, but now I think what is the issue is journalists who are not accredited with a particular armed force, who want to be independent journalists, basically covering both sides. And that's going to be problematic for many reasons. And,
would you agree that this is not in the Hague regulations or in any of the Geneva conventions? So we're trying to extrapolate from general provisions about civilians?
Well, they're
right.
Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead, please.
Well, I think that the Geneva conventions do talk about war correspondents and their entitlement to treatment as POWs, and I think repatriation. I'm doing this off the top of my head, so correct me where I got that wrong. So there is some discussion. I think what's different here is the more explicit statement that journalists may, depending on their conduct, may actually become direct participants in combat operations depending on what they're doing. And that also, that even if they're bona fide journalists trying to do their job, they may nevertheless be subject to censorship because, for example, if they're using a cell phone in the middle of the battlefield to take a picture of something and it's unencrypted and so forth, you know, there's geolocation on that. A good thing for most people taking pictures with their cell phone, but not so good a thing maybe for a military unit in a particular situation. In fact, last fall there was an instance where an ISIS fighter took a photograph, posted it on Facebook or something, and analysts got the geolocation from it, and they ended up bombing them. And this is in the public press. In fact, the commander of Air Combat Command used it as an example of quote-unquote morons using social media in a way that that illustrates what can happen. So I think that the manual, in kind of an awkward and sort of clumsy way, is trying to grapple with the new technologies, the transformation of journalism in the 21st century. And I don't think the law is wrong. I do think it's presented in a way that probably could have been improved upon.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And in the fact, you know, the classic Ernie Pyle war correspondent who's carrying an ID card and, you know, what General Dunlap terms an embed, absolutely foreseen in the Geneva Conventions of 1949 and used. And you know, he alluded, I think, to one of the other core U.S. interests here, which is the changing status of civilians directly participating in hostilities. There's an area where we do have pretty substantial daylight between us and some of our allies, and
right,
really important issues to talk about. So even where we agree on the basic rule, you know, no responsible commander ever intentionally targets civilians, you're not going to get any debate on that. The question is, what are the factors that might lead a commander and a lawyer, as a matter of U.S. policy, to contemplate? And, you know, and the corollary questions then flow, is there a duty to capture, under what circumstances, if not? You know, there's no part of the law of war that requires you, and the ICRC will admit this in their private, candid moments, that requires you to attempt capture when use of force is authorized and permissible under the laws of war. No question about that. but agreeing on the basic principle, and I think this is a good example. General Dunlap used the word clumsy. This is where we get the law right. We're even in a manual this long, not giving some of the depth and some of the granular examples and some of the factors that might help clarify the sharp points where we, with the application of the law, should reflect U.S. interests. And, you know, there's other places. I probably found a half dozen or so places that just jumped out to me where we've done the same kind of thing. You know, even where we get the law absolutely correct, we leave it at a level where we really haven't pushed the recognition of the validity of the U.S. policy position in the right direction. We haven't advanced the debate. And I think, for you know, I'd like to hope that over the near-term future, somebody at DOD says, okay, the basic manual is out. Now, how do we use this to advance the because the whole point is making this simpler and easier for commanders. I had a special operator say to me within the last week, he said, if I can't look at the enemy because I'm too busy looking over my shoulder, I can't do my job. And a big part of the manual going forward needs to be clarifying those gaps and ambiguities so that people can focus on doing their job better.
I agree with Mike. I think that, in fairness to the drafters of the manual, I think that, and I don't know this, but it would not surprise me that in the interagency process, they spent so much energy just trying to get some kind of statement of the law to the point where there would not be an affirmative objection as opposed to an affirmative endorsement. That when that process became so complicated, it was hard to go the next step and have more illustrations or examples and so forth that give you the greater depth. So the manual really is, you know, iteration. It's the Law of War Manual 1.0. And as Mike said, we do need a 2.0 and 3.0 and 3.1 and so forth, and we can do it. But I do think that it needs, you know, the right people collected. And just as an aside, one of the observations I have about Charlie Savage's Power Wars book is that, and he doesn't seem to realize this, I think that there are many flaws. I'm one of the few critics of that book, even though I think it's worthy of being read. He and apparently the people he focuses interview, you know, they wring their hands about certain law of war issues, realizing that military lawyers in the field were addressing far more complex ones, and they were doing it without the benefit of a law of war manual. And I think that some of the things that they wrung their hands about would have been rather easily handled by somebody who had more experience. That said, I do think that we have to have some sort of translation, so to speak, of this very long document into exactly what we're going to be teaching and briefing commanders on. And there needs to be a lot of thought given to, okay, what in this manual do we need to distill down in a way that will be understandable to commanders, not to mention, you know, the 18-year-old in a high-stress combat situation being shot at.
I hate to interrupt this awesome discussion. Maybe we can find a way to continue it in some other forum, but we're actually already over time, unfortunately. But on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank all of our contributors for having this conversation today, and thanks to everybody who was on the line listening. Keep checking back on our teleforum page to see when the next one is scheduled. But with that, we are adjourned. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.